Alaska residents are tough individuals, but many here suffer with a disproportionate amount of healthcare challenges. Substance abuse problems, diabetes, depression, and suicide rates are high, in some areas the highest in the nation. So how is the healthcare industry dealing with chronic illness in a time of rising rates of addiction and lower amounts of funding to combat these problems? The strain on our healthcare system is today's discussion on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. There's been some disturbing healthcare-related Alaska stories recently. Shortages at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute have led to overburdened emergency rooms in Anchorage hospitals, forcing staff to deal with mental health crises that they are not equipped to handle. Addiction rates are so high that the governor made it a disaster declaration last year. And on top of opioid addiction, there are signs that methamphetamine is once again surging in use. What's the answer to a health crisis when the state is in deficit spending? Here to help understand the efforts and the challenges that are taking place across Alaska is the State Commissioner of Health and Social Services, Valerie Davidson. Hello, Commissioner.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being here. And also in the studio today is Nancy Merriman. Nancy is the Executive Director of the Alaska Primary Care Association. Welcome, Nancy.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
All right. So you out there listening can also join our conversation if you have questions or if you have experienced problems accessing care. Give us a call statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255 or 478-TALK. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Commissioner Davidson, you and I spoke recently, and I'm having you come back and talk about it again. We had a discussion about the legislative allocations for behavioral health and substance abuse treatment. But before we discuss that funding and how far it will go in meeting the need, kind of lay out some of the basics for us. Since the disaster declaration last year, how has the crisis changed? What are the addiction areas of most concern today? Is it opioids? Is it methamphetamine? Or is alcohol still far and away the biggest concern?
So in our state, alcohol remains the number one killer. Earlier, just a few weeks ago, the Division of Public Health released their latest alcohol report and found that, again, alcohol is our number one killer in Alaska. It's not surprising. It's the easiest drug to be able to get a hold of because alcohol is legal. So what it found is that we are, you know, unfortunately number one in the ways that you don't want to be number one in the country, number one in binge drinking, etc. Where we have made some progress, though, is with young people. Young people are not drinking at the rates they were. And what that tells us is that our prevention activities that a number of folks have undertaken statewide over the period of about the last 5 to 10 years are really beginning to see results.
And so as far as the opioid epidemic that we've seen, is it still getting worse? What are the current numbers telling you?
Well, a couple of years ago, I actually had the opportunity to speak at the Western Governors Association meeting, and I served on a panel with a number of other folks, and we were talking about the challenges of providing health care in a rural state. And other states were rural, but Alaska really is ultra-rural. We're really in a category of our own. And I was asked a question by one of the governors of why we're seeing so much about opioids and heroin in the news these days. And my co-panelists gave these really fabulous answers, and my answer was a lot more direct. What I said was heroin and opioids have actually been around in this country for a really long time. And the challenge has been that it has really plagued communities of color, people who look like me. And it has also existed in socioeconomically disadvantaged communities. And one of the reasons that it's so much in the news and people are seeing it more often, was my answer to the governors, is that it's appearing in other neighborhoods and middle-class neighborhoods and families that look like, you know, regular America. And that the lesson for us really in public health is that if we are aware of issues when they first arise in communities of color or in socioeconomically disadvantaged communities, and we don't take immediate measures to stop them in their tracks, it is just a matter of time before it finds its way into other neighborhoods. So there are a lot of things that have really, as we've done this work, one of the things that Governor Walker did that I was so happy when he did his disaster declaration, the first ever public health disaster declaration in our state's history, and it was about opioids. One, it allowed Dr. Jay Butler, our chief medical officer, to be able to prescribe naloxone, which is a life-saving medication that people can carry on them to be able to save somebody who is overdosing from an opioid. The other thing that Governor Walker did was to create an incident command structure that really brought together all of the commissioners from different departments who were really focused on addressing the opioid problem, everything from treatment to prevention to preventing it from coming into our state, et cetera, and things that you might not consider, you might not necessarily think of. So, for example, a letter was sent before the commercial fishing season last year to folks who were going to be coming to Alaska from the lower 48, typically Washington, that, you know, hey, by the way, you should know that if you have somebody who is bringing drugs on your boat, even if you're not aware, and if they're doing nefarious things with that, like selling those drugs, your boat could be confiscated and it's really going to be a big problem for you. So one is really getting education out there to folks. The other is one of the things that we have learned from talking to folks who are in recovery and who are struggling with addiction is that many times the reason that somebody got hooked on an opioid was because they had a major medical procedure, whether they broke a leg or broke an arm or whether they had oral surgery. It used to be that the standard was you would be given a 30-day prescription for an opioid, even if you only needed it for 2 or 3 days. Legislation that was sponsored by the governor and that passed limited that first-time prescription to 7 days. And it really addresses the issue of there are still folks who take the medicine because the doctor gave it to me and I really should take all of it. That's not true for opioids. You should only take it if absolutely necessary. If folks still have opioids in their medicine cabinets, time to get rid of that stuff.
Get rid of them, yeah.
Exactly. And we actually have drug disposal bags that are available at our public health centers that you can get together with your friends or your neighbors or your family and get those together and put them in the bag. It activates charcoal once you add water and makes them ineffective. The other is that we've done a lot of education with people about you know, why is it that people are medicating, self-medicating? And whether you're talking about opioids or you're talking about alcohol or any, you know, spice or any other drug out there, what we're really trying to get to at the heart of it is why are people self-medicating in the first place? Mm-hmm. What's happening in children's lives that is causing them as adolescents or as adults to seek those self-medicating behaviors.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are discussing healthcare funding and the future of healthcare in Alaska. My guests today are Commissioner of Health and Social Services, Valerie Davidson, and also the Executive Director of the Alaska Primary Care Association, Nancy Merriman. Do you have, and Nancy, thank you for being patient. I want to get you in here soon. Do you have a sense, Commissioner, of how the opioid crisis here compares to other states? Are there any studies about looking at how we rate in the nation?
Well, Alaska's experience in terms of addiction is pretty consistent with the experience of other states. But one thing that we have learned is that other states actually followed Alaska's lead in terms of declaring a disaster. The federal government also just recently did the same thing. Whether it is taking measures like controlling the number of days of a prescription that you can have, tightening down our prescription drug monitoring program that requires providers to look and check the database to see. Let's say, I'll use me for an example. Let's say I had oral surgery. I took 30 days and I got hooked. And I went to see another dentist or I went to see another provider and said, hey, I really am still in pain. Can you give me some more medications? That provider would go on the PDM Prescription Drug Monitoring Program database, PDMP, and look to see, oh gosh, it looks like I just got a prescription yesterday that was filled for 7 days. And it looks like I tried to access another prescription at another location. But it also requires pharmacists, if something slips through the cracks, it requires pharmacists to be able to look at the PDMP and see, well, it looks like I can't give this prescription to Val because she just got a prescription 4 days ago or 2 days ago. And so all of those measures in place to help to make sure that we don't exacerbate the problem in Alaska.
How recent were those rules put in place?
So very recently. The PDMP has been in place for a while, but it was required to only be updated every 30 days. And the new rule requires it to be updated every 7 days.
Mm. All right. So much more responsive and current. Nancy Merriman, Executive Director of Alaska Primary Care Association. Your association has been in existence for about 23 years or so, I think
it
is.
Yes, that's correct.
And your mission is to ensure every Alaskan has access to basic health care. Your organization provides training and support. Tell us more about how this came about, this ambitious concept to make, in your organization's words, medical underservice a thing of the past.
Well, in 1995, the Alaska Primary Care Association was formed. It is one of 52 primary care associations across the country. We are, as in many things, each primary care association is unique. Here in Alaska, we are funded by a variety of grants, and some of which are federal grants. And so the purpose of the primary care associations was really to support the community health center movement, which started more than 50 years ago by some really smart people who thought that everybody in a community should be able to have access to comprehensive and coordinated health care, no matter their coverage status or their ability to pay for that care. And so they created this model of community-driven, community-governed, community-shaped comprehensive health care in these clinics, which receive grants from the federal government that helps them cover the difference in cost between the cost of care and what someone can actually pay. So the door is open to anybody in a community. And they're not free clinics. There is an expectation that a patient would come in and help pay for their own care. But knowing how expensive care is, these community health centers have the ability to cover the cost of some of that care for people who are uninsured. And in fact, currently 25% of patients who are seen in community health centers here in Alaska do not have health insurance. So it's available to everybody, but the association was really put into place to help community health center staff and clinicians be able to provide excellent health care for their patients.
So a quarter of the patients that are seen don't have any form of insurance. That must mean that you need to have people coming to your these facilities that do have insurance to kind of help balance things out. Is that accurate?
A variety of payer mix certainly helps the community health centers be sustainable because they are not free clinics and do expect for patients to contribute to their own care. And in that way, too, patients really take more of an accountability for their own care. So yes, it is true that about a quarter of patients are uninsured. About a third of patients across the state in community health centers have private insurance. And then about 9% have Medicare and about a third have Medicaid.
Mm-hmm. How would you say that the need has changed in the past two decades? What was going on in 1995 as opposed to what you're seeing today?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting shift, a paradigm shift, really, for both patients and the healthcare system. 20, 30 years ago, really, people went to the doctor when they were sick. And now patients are learning that, and clinicians, certainly we've always known this, but if patients get preventative primary care, they're more likely to stay healthy. They're more likely to catch conditions early in their progress so that they can be taken care of, that patients can be engaged in how to manage those more chronic conditions and really be a part of their health care. So it becomes more of a health care system rather than a sick care system. Mm-hmm. Community health centers have always known this. They've always been patient-centered, comprehensive healthcare providers. And so in being so, we've kind of helped the patients that come to community health centers have their own paradigm shift, that they don't have to wait to be sick to come to the doctor. They should come, get primary care, get preventative care, take a look at your entire body, your oral health, vision, behavioral, mental health, as well as your medical, physical health.
The holistic approach.
Yes.
This is Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the future of healthcare and healthcare funding in our state in a time of deficit spending. You can join our conversation if you'd like to at 1-800-478-8255. If you have questions or you've had problems yourself accessing care, 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 550-8422. 550-8422 is the number in Anchorage. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We're going to go to the phone for just a moment. Steve is in Wasilla. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
Did you have a question?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I didn't have a question, but one of the things I'm working on is pursuing my degree to go and help the Alaska Native patients in Alaska Psychiatric Institute. I was listening in earlier, and I heard that the hospital there is, well, overflowing. Well, while I was a patient there, I'm Alaska Native myself, so I naturally talked to a lot of the other Alaska Natives there, and I got to asking them, how long have you been here? How long have you been here? And several answers were, I've been here for 3 months, I've been here for 4 months. There was a couple of patients that have been there for 7 months and longer. And I asked them, so what is it that's keeping you here? And their answer was always, oh, I'm not getting the help that I need. And I was like, well, what is it that you need? I mean, why aren't you getting the help? The most common answer was the cultural differences. There was a cultural barrier there. So I started listening to their problems. I started writing them down. I started giving, you know, talking to the staff and saying, hey, you know, this person has been here for this long. And they're like, yeah, we can't get him to talk. It's, you know, a surprise that he's even talking to you. What's he telling you? I said, it's funny you should ask. He's telling me that he's not getting the help because he's afraid to talk to you because of that cultural barrier. So one by one, each patient would come up to me, tell me their problems, what they hope to get as far as help, and I would bring it to the staff's attention, and one by one, these patients were being discharged. So I started college last week to obtain, pursue a degree, to go back to Alaska Psychiatric Institute to try to help out as many patients as I can.
Well, thank you, Steve. You really raised an interesting point, and one that Commissioner Davidson and I have discussed in the past about the different ways of treating people based on a wide range of things, because everyone is so different. So as you've said, there's no magic bullet or magic pill. Talk a little bit about looking more broadly at that. And Nancy, I'm sure that there's room for you to come into this part of the conversation too, about recognizing that people have a wide range, especially in Alaska. We have such a diverse state here. It's ethnically rich across the state. And that means that we have to look at those things from a more holistic approach about how people's background, what their background experience has been, what their family experience was, and how that will inform what kind of care will be most effective for them. Commissioner.
Thank you. So first of all, I wanted to say, Steve Guyana, for your dedication. And while you were there, I really appreciate you making patients comfortable so that they could communicate what their concerns are. One of the things that I learned in the 15 years that I worked in tribal health is that if we can provide care as close to home as possible and in a culturally appropriate environment and speaking in a language that people understand and are comfortable with, we have much better outcomes. And so one of the reasons that we are pursuing an 1115 behavioral health waiver in Alaska, it's a waiver that we are now negotiating with CMS, our federal counterparts, is to really look at redesigning our entire behavioral health system, because we have some pretty significant gaps in our behavioral health system. And right now, a lot of our resources are going to really crisis-driven, urban-based centers. And so what we would like to be able to do is to be able to intervene sooner to make sure that preventive and first opportunity services are available in every community in Alaska, including our rural communities, and really look at prevention and being able to get care to folks first and sooner at the first opportunity that there might be an issue, and not wait until it has gone untreated so long that somebody is having an acute psychiatric episode and they need a crisis intervention at API here in Anchorage.
Could also endanger other people. So it's not just one person that is at risk at that point.
Yes. And the other piece is that we have also heard from folks that, and certainly from the legislature, that they would like more accountability of our behavioral health system. So the 1115 waiver is designed to do that as well. Now, the challenge is, and I'm glad that Steve mentioned API, and the challenge, when we've had a number of challenges at API, and they're not recent, they actually go back much farther. If you look at the history of API in its heyday in 1965, API actually had 225 beds. Our current facility has 80 beds. When the facility in the 60s and 70s was clearly in a state of disrepair in the 80s and the 90s, and a new facility was being contemplated, there were a number of reports, analyses, studies that looked at what's the right size that we should build a facility to replace API. And based upon that work, the consensus of those reports was we needed a facility that had about 140 beds total. Those would include 40 forensic beds. And instead, funds were provided that would allow us to be able to build 80 beds and 10 forensic beds. And so I don't care what line of business you're in, whether you're in healthcare, whether you're in construction, whether you're in some private business, if you go from a demonstrated need of 140 and you build to 80, it is just a matter of time before you are going to have a problem. And that's where we're at today.
Well, and when you think about the fact that in 1965, we had maybe half the population mm-hmm. that we have now, and so far less beds in a much greater population base, and also facing this addiction crisis that we've seen in the state. So, Commissioner, I know that you mentioned, I think, 10 forensics. Is it 10? Would you help us understand what those, what that means?
Sure. Forensics. So forensic beds are beds that are designated for Alaskans who have been charged with a crime, but they are not mentally competent to stand trial. And so that may, for some folks, that may be they've been taking meds, but they're not taking their meds. So they're off their meds and they may have become violent, or maybe they were trespassing. And we have to, and sometimes medication and additional treatment, we can get them to the point where they are back on track and they're competent to stand trial. There are other folks for whom we know that medication is not going to make a difference. And so for those folks, we anticipate that they will have a longer stay. But if the demonstrated need in 2005 was 40 forensic beds, and we have 25% of those, that's a problem for us in our state.
Yeah. Nancy, I want to know how your association works to meet those challenges that Steve described about people coming into a system, maybe where a lot of people that are the professionals there don't look anything like you or have the same type of cultural understanding that you may have. How do you work to help people feel like they can still trust what's happening and be able to communicate their needs and feel confident that even though everybody's different than I am, they're going to do the best by me?
Right. So, Steve, first of all, thank you for demonstrating commitment and passion for your fellow Alaskans and really identifying what the need was and then really helping to solve it. It's that kind of spirit that is really embodied throughout community health. And so I hope that as you pursue your degree and your career in healthcare, that you look to community health for a home. There are many, many positions that are open in our community health center system specifically that would really benefit from that kind of passion. So congratulations. As I speak about community health centers, that's really the focus and the main core of the association. But really, we're speaking about concepts of care delivery, which are really delivered in many different kinds of practice settings. There are 27 community health center organizations in Alaska, and 14 of them are part of the Alaska Tribal Health System. 13 of them are other independent nonprofits, and together they operate about 170 clinics across the state. Mm. And they are located in the smallest of small communities, and those clinic locations are really staffed by people, ideally from that community. We know that the Alaska Tribal Health System has a great model in the community health aid and practitioners. And that, I think, really is exemplary of what Steve talks about having somebody from the community who looks like you, who identifies with your environment and your needs and your culture. There is a new kind of position that's being developed in the state called a community health worker. And although that sounds like a community health aide, it's very different. A community health aide is a very clinical kind of position. A community health worker is more of, it can be anything from an RN to a layperson who's trained in some skills that help patients navigate the healthcare system, that help coordinate physicians and care so that the patients different physicians' care plans are all matched up, mm-hmm. and that communication happens among those providers, helping them to address other kinds of social determinants of health that we know are really important to health status, like housing, like food security, like transportation. And community health workers can do all of that because they are from that community. They can relate to folks. They can go out into homes and really help people look at their home setting and see, if there are any kinds of barriers to good health there. And a great example of that is I know somebody who is helping a couple really navigate the system, talking to insurance over the phone, and has taken a lot of time to do that, as we know that that takes a lot of time to kind of go through that process. She spent some time in the couple's home and was trying to figure out why the older gentleman couldn't figure out how to take his medications. Well, turns out he hadn't been able to see very well for 3 years, and he couldn't read the labels on the bottles. Mm. And you wouldn't know that unless you were at that, were meeting the person where they are at.
Absolutely. Community health workers, another career path for people who want to help their neighbors and get into the healthcare field. We are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation on the future of healthcare in Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the future of healthcare in our state. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK statewide. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Michelle is in Juneau. Hello, Michelle.
Yeah, hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I do. First, I wanted to thank Valerie Davidson for her hard work, and Jay Butler and Governor Walker for what he's done. I met Valerie at the signing of Senate Bill 23, which allowed naloxone to be distributed in our state. So that was wonderful. My question is, in the hepatitis C rates in Alaska have increased. Here where I live in Southeast Alaska, over the last 2 years, they've increased 490%, and about 200% in most other places in the state. And I was wondering what, if we have anything on the horizon for harm reduction. A lot of that is from IV drug users. And I know that in other states, they have implemented more needle exchange programs, more safe places to get safe supplies. And I was wondering if the panel had any answers on that question.
Thank you, Michelle, for an excellent question. We did do some reporting on that recently about needle exchanges here in Anchorage and a few other locations. But, Commissioner, what's known about more broadly statewide in Southeast as where Michelle is?
So I know that that public health centers are taking needles for folks who have needles that they would like to dispose of for safe disposal. But you're right that the rates of Hep C have really gone up. One of the things that has been helpful on the back end is that Medicaid does pay for Hep C, the Hep C drugs, which were very, very expensive, and they have recently come down, but they're still beyond the reach of the average Alaskan. One of the things that has really helped us to be able to address that issue is Medicaid expansion. Mm. Over 42,500 Alaskans are now covered, have been covered by Medicaid expansion since September 1st of 2015. And almost $1 billion in claims have been paid out since that time, about $900 million. And almost all of that has been federal. And quite frankly, there were folks who, about 80% of the people who are covered by Medicaid are actually in working households. And these were folks who just weren't making enough money to be able to afford private health insurance, or they worked for an employer who didn't have that coverage. Mm-hmm. But you're right, Michelle, that we definitely can do more on prevention of Hep C and more for needle exchange. I know that beyond urban centers, I know that in rural communities, the clinics will take used needles as well for safe exchange.
And can they exchange? Do they have clean needles to offer at all the clinics, or is it not across the state?
Right now, it's mostly disposal, not necessarily clean needles back. Okay.
Is there a plan to try to expand that to other communities?
It's something that we're looking at right now, and we just need to have a little more conversation.
Mm-hmm. Let's stay with the phones for a moment. Francine is in Anchorage. Hi, Francine.
Hello, Kriana, Commissioner Valerie. I have a statement of gratitude and then a question. 2018 marks my 30th year being involved in behavior health, mental health, emotional health, first as a person who needed a lot of help recovering from a couple of serious mental health conditions. And then I spent 15 years at NAMI Anchorage, National Alliance on Mental Illness, and I'm now over at Stone Soup Group, which is an organization that helps people with developmental disabilities, and I'm particularly interested in FASD. The note of gratitude is thank you for saying on the public radio that, you know, we need to ask the reason why people are picking up addictive substances and not condemn them from the get-go. We have way too many policymakers and members of the public who just immediately jump to the person having a character defect, the person having been brought up badly. So there's condemnation of both the parents and the individual, and then these particular policymakers and taxpayers then jump to their conclusion, which is they deserve what they're doing. They don't deserve our help or our sympathy. And as a person who had a mental health condition and was really blessed to not have gotten caught up in the trap of depending on substances, because I was able to get help from the community mental health care system, I really wish there was a way that those of us who couldn't, you know, but there wasn't the grace of God, you know, we could have ended up there too, could get paid to go down to Juno and really speak, you know, get on a long table just like the oil experts do and have the rapt attention of the policymakers and listen to us as seriously as they listen to the oil executives. That's a thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. And then the second thing is a question. I have a very strong position on what it's going to take to prevent those seven-year stays for Alaska Natives and other communities, and other members of the community who don't feel comfortable communicating with people who are coming out of the, you know, the Eurocentric Western model, not only of medicine, but of communication, the way people talk. And my position on that is that the onus, we cannot put the responsibilities on the community members who are challenged and off-put with speaking with the Western Eurocentric model. It has got to be on those of us who grew up there and who were trained there. You know, I'm white. My ancestors came from Europe, and I came from the East Coast, New York City area. And boy, when I moved up here, I was told you will have to speak a lot less, a lot more quietly, and a lot slower if you're going to make it up here. And I was grateful for getting that. I got that. I was just a baby lawyer. I was in a courtroom, and there was a lawyer who was, you know, bent over speaking with, I believe, a man from the North Slope who had unfortunately ended up in court, and she was practically whispering to him. She was white, and she was practically whispering to him. And my mentor attorney said, "Do you see what she's doing there?" And I said, "Yeah." You know, that's the kind of communication skills we white people need to learn.
Well,
so my question is, would you agree with me that the onus needs to be on, you know, mostly, you know, the people who have these kind of attitudes are mostly white people with a Eurocentric Western perspective, and they have to, we have to put in school curriculums, medical curriculums, we have to have long talks with the politicians. I mean, this is not going to change until we take on the responsibility, because we're the ones who have the privilege and we're the ones who are doing the othering.
All right. Well, thank you, Francine. You've raised a lot of issues. And, you know, as she was talking, it reminded me of when I was a young mom taking my kids to the doctor and asking questions and being met with sort of this, like, who do you think you're asking questions of here? You shouldn't be questioning me. I'm the doctor. I'll tell you what's going to happen. And that's all you need to know. And I remember being quite off put by that, that I had questions about what are the effects that I could expect from vaccinations and other things. You know, what should I watch for? Will my child be sick? Will they be more tired? Is there, you know, will their appetite be affected? And the doctor was rude to me. And, you know, that's changed a lot, I think, from the many decades ago when I was a young mother. But I think Francine raises an important point about trying to do a better job of being more culturally aware. But also, Commissioner, and I want you to weigh in here, and Nancy, your experience also in the community health clinic setting, there's a responsibility on both sides, it seems to me. So what would you say about that, Commissioner?
So my very best health care provider for my entire life, and I've seen lots of them, continues to be to this day Clara Morgan, who is a community health practitioner who retired after many years of service in Aniak. She still lives there. So Clara, if you're listening, hello and huaqa. And one of the things that, one of the reasons that Clara was so effective is that she was from our community. She spoke our language. She looked like us. She knew all our tricks. She knew us since we were babies, and quite frankly knew us before we were born because she knew our mothers. And so was a really, really effective communicator. Mm-hmm. And we knew that when Clara told us to do something, she meant business. And when she walked into the gym for a basketball game, the kids sat up straighter and we made better choices just seeing her in the room. And it's really those kinds of experiences that really shape people's healthcare decisions. If you know the person who is your provider and you connect with them and you get to know them and you trust them, you have much better health outcomes because you're much more likely to be able to listen to that person. It's one of the reasons why community health aides, behavioral health aides, dental health aides, and dental therapists are so effective in communities in Alaska, is because they identify with the people who they're serving because they are those people. It's also why community health centers are so effective, is because they are people who live in that community, many times people who grew up there. I will say, though, that there has been this really interesting shift in our country, and what we, in terms of behavioral health, what we have learned in our history is that vilifying people who need access to behavioral health services, whether it's mental health services or whether it's treatment, substance use disorder treatment, is not working. Vilifying folks and making people feel ashamed or having to speak about it really quietly or hide the fact that they need treatment or that they're seeking treatment or getting treatment is not effective. We've been doing that in this country for years, and it's making the problem worse, not better. One of the reasons that we have been focused so much on redesigning our behavioral health system in Alaska is because we recognize that we need to do something different. We were really happy this year that the governor, as a part of his public safety action plan, requested $18 million from the legislature in the 19 budget for additional substance use disorder treatment services. The legislature ultimately funded $12 million of that, and that will go for everything from detox to treatment to a sobering or crisis intervention center, and perhaps some like housing assistance to help people get back on their feet. But the other thing that I've noticed is that I'm not sure when it happened in our country, but it seems like there was this, it seems like somehow in our country, it seemed to become sport to be mean to poor people. And I think it's one of the most heartbreaking things to see and experience in our country, that it should not be okay to be mean to poor people and to make fun of people or criticize people who need help being able to get out of a bad situation.
As if something's wrong with them because they might have struggling economic conditions.
Yes. And really getting to the heart of what's that trauma that's happening in childhood, or what is a traumatic experience that a person is going through right now that if they don't address it, will come back in really unfortunate ways later in life.
We are going to stop right there for just a moment, take a quick break, and come back and continue our conversation on the future of healthcare in Alaska on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing a wide range of issues related to health, and not all of them, you know, directly related to bandages and medication, but the much broader societal implications of how we see each other and how we treat each other in these conversations. Nancy, you wanted to add something here related to the opioid problem.
Yeah, thanks, Lori. I did. When Francine, when you were talking about condemnation for people who fall into addiction, I was reminded of all of the education and research and reading that I've done. Now, I am not a clinician, so I will not pretend to be an expert in this area, but we have learned a lot about opioids over the last 30 years, and there was a lot of misinformation about opioids early on, about how they were not addictive and how they could help certain people and not others, and how they would be addictive in this situation but not the other. Physicians were encouraged to prescribe opioids. So there's a deep history of which Dr. Jay Butler is an expert and has a fantastic presentation. Where we are now, though, is a whole new era of understanding what those kinds of drugs do to a person's brain. And they actually make permanent changes to a person's brain, so that what started as taking a pill for pain relief becomes a true chronic condition that needs to be treated. So I think it really needs to be a paradigm shift about how we think about addiction and how people in recovery are really dealing with a condition which is chronic and needs to be handled by a team of professionals and a community team. And we've had really good experience, I think, in this state with really innovative partnerships with some unlikely partners, hospitals and primary care, behavioral health, mental health, substance abuse, and the government, and some grassroots community efforts that many times have been started by people in recovery who have not found what they needed. And those partnerships are really coming to bear fruit in how to relate to folks who have these now chronic conditions because of something that started innocently with a prescription.
And legally. And
right.
With a prescription. It seems like we need to have a different conversation about what it means to manage pain also in our country, that the expectation that you should have no pain seems a little unrealistic and tending toward the dangerous. It seems like if you've had a major surgery or a major accident or something, yes, then you may have a short-term need for a lot of pain blocking. But pain is a messenger, and it's telling you, don't walk on that leg, it's broken, you know. So you don't want to blot out all of it and then raise that risk, it seems, of addiction. But dealing with chronic pain, we had an email from Tom in Fairbanks who says the only sliding scale clinic, which is otherwise excellent, will not help existing patients with chronic pain. After a short-term course of painkillers, even if they are effective, they're cut off with no referral to any provider that accepts chronic pain. And if the patient doesn't have good insurance, they can't pay for another provider. What's being done to help those with chronic pain, especially if they don't have good insurance? This is his question. Is there, it's a very complicated question. How do you handle things like that? And going back to the issue of why are people self-medicating, it seems like it should be more a question of looking at what's available for self-medication. People have always self-medicated since as long as there's been human beings, they've found a way to alter their state. But the difference between chewing on a coca leaf for a little bit of a caffeinated type of pickup, the same with a cup of coffee or something like that, versus crack cocaine is a huge leap. And so the difference between some of the substances that people once used many, many years ago to alleviate pain is so different than the concentrated pharmaceuticals that are available, the very, very powerful drugs that are available today. So how can that conversation shift to look realistically at what's really happening now?
So you're right. Let me answer his question,
please.
Tom's question first. So under the legislation that limited first-time prescriptions, it was limited to 7 days. There are exceptions. Providers can prescribe longer under certain circumstances. If somebody's under a chronic pain management plan, or if somebody is suffering from cancer or some other kind of condition that requires longer pain management, there are exceptions for that. There are some pain management clinics here in Anchorage. I don't know of the availability of pain management in Fairbanks. It sounds like from Tom's email, it sounds like they have a need for additional services there. But getting back to your question, one of the things that certainly exacerbated our opioid challenge is that in hospitals and in clinics, we were often and still to this day are asked, you know, where's your pain scale on this scale of 1 to 10? And when folks were being discharged from hospitals, one of their review standards was how the extent to which a patient was still experiencing pain. And so, you know, looking back, hindsight is always 20/20. But that was probably not the best thing to ask folks and have that be used by hospitals and healthcare providers for good service, because we actually did ourselves a disservice.
Because it sort of sets up that expectation that, well, if you did a successful job, I shouldn't have any pain when I leave. Mm-hmm. Is that what sort of...
Yes, and it really encouraged over-medication or medication where it may not have been required to make sure that the patient was comfortable.
We're going to sneak one more call in quickly in our final few moments here. Joel is in Cake. Hi, Joel.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I've been listening to you guys, and, I know Valerie personally, and... It's good to hear you, Valerie, I'd like to thank you for all your hard work. And my opinion, of course, is always on getting law enforcement into our little villages. Because without law enforcement, which is the basic right of all Alaskans to be safe, and we have all these drugs coming into our little villages, it's hard to get anybody in any position that is using drugs and whatever to get them into treatment. And there's no treatment facilities in Alaska, because I've checked, you know, and if they are, what few they are, it's very, very long waiting list on them. So, you know, I appreciate everybody's hard work on it, but we've got to face the reality that we need to upgrade our whole system, starting with law enforcement, which is the key to all of this, to make sure people follow their treatment program.
Yes. Thank you, Joel. We only have a couple minutes left. I want to give the commissioner and Nancy a chance to respond. And he's highlighting, of course, a very important piece in all of, you know, we've been talking wide, you know, wide ranging terms, but coming back a lot to addiction, because that is such a huge problem right now, not only in Alaska, but a lot of places. But yes, as you mentioned, there's legislation that addresses vessel owners, so that when people are coming into the state through what is a very porous border system, when they can come in by vessel and no one is really checking them at the border, there's that piece there. But law enforcement is certainly a big part of what we need in rural Alaska in conjunction with these addiction services.
Well, first I have to say hello to my Uncle Joel Jackson from Cake. One of the things I appreciate about Alaska is you can always count on your family to tell you the truth, and I appreciate that very much. And he's right that law enforcement is a key to being able to prevent drugs from getting in the first place, or to get alcohol into communities where alcohol is in a dry community, so it's prohibited. One of the things that happened in the Public Safety Action Plan that was taken up by this legislature is additional funding to be able to improve recruitment for VPSOs, and also the $12 million in funding for substance use disorder treatment services, because we know that we don't have enough treatment available. The other piece is that for Medicaid expansion, for the 42,500 Alaskans who are now enrolled in Medicaid expansion, over $62 million have been paid in claims for behavioral health services that were not services that people were able to get before. We're excited about the opportunities to be able to bring services to every community sooner as a part of our 1115 behavioral health waiver. We're still negotiating that with CMS, our federal partners. But you're right, Uncle Joel, that it isn't happening as fast as any of us would like. The important thing is that we are making progress in the right direction.
And let's give Nancy just in a few seconds here.
Sure.
Nancy, what's your response to this part of the conversation?
So we know that a lot of behavioral health services and, in fact, substance use disorder services are provided in the community health center situation. And so we have several providers who are beginning to offer medically assisted therapy in the health center scenario. And so encourage people to check that out.
All right. Well, I was hoping that we could get to what should the future look like as far as how healthcare should be distributed more broadly. But we'll save that for another conversation and have you come back and talk about the prospect of should it be single payer? What should it be? And I want to say thank you to my guest today, Commissioner of Health and Social Services, Valerie Davidson, and Executive Director of the Alaska Primary Care Association, Nancy Merriman. Thanks to Dave Waldron and Wesley Early on phones. Thanks for listening. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.